When news of Richard Wagner's death reached the world on February 13, 1883, it triggered an unprecedented wave of mourning. 5,000 telegrams flooded Venice within 24 hours, while memorial concerts erupted across Europe and America. The composer's funeral procession along Venice's Grand Canal featured ceremonial boats playing Siegfried's funeral music, a fitting tribute to a man whose influence would extend far beyond music. Today, Wagner remains both revered and reviled, his legacy claimed by artistic revolutionaries and political extremists alike. His works have inspired everyone from Baudelaire to Hitler, from feminist pioneers to gay rights activists. Even those who've never attended an opera recognize the Ride of the Valkyries from Apocalypse Now or the bridal chorus from countless weddings. As Thomas Mann observed, Wagner became the most volcanically controversial artist who ever lived, a cultural force whose shadow still looms over our modern world. Wagner never intended to be merely a composer. He created a revolutionary artistic model that transcended traditional boundaries, writing his own libretti, developing the concept of Gesamtkunstwerk, total artwork, and building his own theater at Bayreuth to realize his vision. His most ambitious creation, the four-opera Ring Cycle, began during the revolutionary year 1848 when Wagner embraced leftist politics in Dresden. The Ring emerged as a radical critique of industrial capitalism, with the Rheingold representing wealth's corrupting power and the gods symbolizing a doomed aristocracy. Wagner's political vision evolved alongside his artistic one. After discovering Schopenhauer's philosophy in 1854, his worldview darkened considerably. Wotan's monologue in Die Walküre, where the god realizes his powerlessness and inevitable downfall, reflects this pessimistic turn. Wagner wrote to a friend that this scene produced a sense of shock beyond anything previously experienced. The composer's growing disillusionment with revolutionary politics mirrored his character's tragic fates. The 1876 Bayreuth Festival premiere of the complete Ring Cycle attracted luminaries from Kaiser Wilhelm I to Emperor Don Pedro II of Brazil. But the atmosphere disappointed philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche, who found it overrun by bored, unmusical aristocrats. The commercialization appalled him. Shops sold tacky merchandise with Wagner's face on beer mugs and cigar boxes. Wagner himself fell into dejection after the festival, having lost money and feeling dissatisfied with the productions. "R is very sad, says he wishes he could die," his wife Cosima recorded. Wagner spoke of giving up the festival entirely and disappearing, sensing how far he'd fallen from his original vision of a free festival in a meadow. Nietzsche's break with Wagner exemplifies the composer's polarizing effect. Initially worshiping Wagner as the only prize I have received in life, Nietzsche later attacked him as a desperate charlatan. Yet even in his anti-Wagner polemics, Nietzsche revealed his continued adoration, calling Tristan a work of dangerous fascination, and naming Wagner the greatest benefactor of my life. As Thomas Mann observed, Nietzsche's attacks were really panegyrics with the sign reversed. Wagner's influence spread far beyond Germany, particularly in France, where Charles Baudelaire became his most eloquent and passionate champion. After attending Wagner's 1860 Paris concerts at the Théâtre Italien, Baudelaire wrote an extraordinary essay, Richard Wagner et Tannhäuser à Paris, describing his experience in deeply sensual and transformative terms. The Lohengrin Prelude, he claimed, made him feel released from the bonds of gravity and experience an ecstasy composed of knowledge and joy. This visceral response reflected Baudelaire's own artistic philosophy. He connected Wagner's goal of reunifying the arts with his own synesthetic command of senses, responding with the ardor of an addict. Particularly telling was his preference for the profane Venusberg music over the sacred elements in Tannhäuser, mirroring his own poetic fascination with beauty in the forbidden. The 1861 Tannhäuser scandal at the Paris Opera became a defining moment for French Wagnerism, revealing deep cultural divisions in French society. aristocratic jockey club members, protecting their traditional ballet-focused entertainment, deliberately disrupted performances with hunting whistles and orchestrated catcalls. Though Wagner withdrew the opera after three chaotic performances, the controversy only enhanced his reputation among artistic progressives who saw him as a martyr to bourgeois philistinism. The incident crystallized the divide between conservative and avant-garde culture in France, with Wagner becoming a symbolic figurehead for artistic revolution. By the 1880s, a new literary vanguard had emerged in France, led by poets like Paul Verlaine, Stéphane Mallarmé, and Arthur Rimbaud, who explored uncanny images and dreams through dense, often impenetrable language. These symbolists rejected naturalist claims to objective reality, seeking hidden truths beyond appearance. Mallarmé's famous Tuesday evening salons became gathering points for Wagnerians, where discussions of the composer's theories of Gesamtkunstwerk, total artwork, influenced a generation of poets and artists. French painters increasingly adopted Wagnerian influences, developing new visual languages to capture music's emotional power. Henri Fantin-Latour created dozens of works inspired by Wagner's operas, using an aesthetic of vagueness that mirrored Bayreuth's phantasmagoria. His misty, dreamlike canvases attempted to translate musical experience into visual form. Paul Cézanne's Wagnerism peaked during his Romantic period, with works like Young Girl at the Piano, originally titled Overture to Tannhäuser, showing how musical themes could inspire pictorial composition. Vincent van Gogh explicitly associated Wagner with explosions of color, writing that he sought to make of painting what the music of Berlioz and Wagner has been before us, a total sensory experience that transcended traditional artistic boundaries. By century's end, Wagner references had become routine among French artists, with his journey from controversial outsider to cultural titan serving as the ultimate model of avant-garde success. His influence extended beyond direct musical references, shaping how artists thought about the relationship between different art forms and the possibility of creating overwhelming multisensory experiences. The French absorption of Wagner demonstrated how artistic influence could cross national and cultural boundaries, transforming both the source and receiving cultures in the process. Wagner's reception in Victorian Britain was complicated by the era's view of music as a medium of moral uplift. Critics initially resisted him, with J.W. Davison of the Times deriding him as a desperate charlatan. His anti-Jewish sentiments, particularly his criticism of the beloved Mendelssohn, further complicated his British reception. Nevertheless, by the early 1880s, Wagnerism had become phenomenal in Britain, with the 1882 London performances of The Ring drawing the Prince of Wales and William Gladstone. The Pre-Raphaelites developed a sudden interest in Wagner's material around 1861. Burne Jones created a watercolor titled Laus Veneris. Swinburne wrote a poem with the same title, and Morris began The Hill of Venus. Despite these parallels, Morris loathed Wagner, calling it desecration to bring such material under the gaslights of an opera. Yet Morris's epic, The Story of Sigurd the Volsung, seems influenced by Wagner's Ring, though Morris's more flowery language contrasts with Wagner's directness. In America, Wagner's music first reached audiences through the Germania Musical Society, radical-minded musicians who formed a collective in Berlin in 1848 before emigrating together. German-born conductor Theodore Thomas became Wagner's most decisive American advocate after the Civil War. His 1872 performance of The Ride of the Valkyries caused audiences to jump on chairs and shout with excitement. Wagner's influence extended to American composers like John Philip Sousa, who arranged the Star-Spangled Banner in Tannhäuser style. The Chicago School architects embraced Wagner's ideals of unifying the arts. Louis Sullivan became an ardent Wagnerite after hearing Thomas conduct Lohengrin, finding in Wagner a mighty personality, a great free spirit, who gave him tenfold courage in this raw city by the Great Lake. The auditorium, designed by Adler and Sullivan, represented a democratic alternative to the Met's elite boxes, using a more egalitarian fan-shaped seating plan inspired by the Festspielhaus. Wagner's Parsifal opened a realm where time becomes space, as the sage Gurnemanz tells the foolish young hero. This enigmatic work, which Wagner called his stage consecration festival play, belongs to no single religion. Despite its Christian elements, it incorporates Gnostic teachings, pagan nature worship, and Eastern influences, including Buddhism. As philosopher Ernst Bloch summarized, Parsifal is Christian, Buddhist, Rosicrucian art religion. The work became a supreme, enigmatic symbol during the Fin de Siècle, when artists everywhere sensed an imminent revelation. Pilgrims to Bayreuth sought private quests toward hidden worlds, Catholic mystery, Gnostic riddle, Buddhist enlightenment, or even Black Mass. This era of esotericism saw the rise of occultism, Satanism, theosophy, and various reinventions of medieval sects. Wagner blended perfectly with this mystical milieu. Edward Charette called him the greatest unconscious occultist who ever lived, while Rudolf Steiner declared his works contained a very large measure of occult power. Belgium proved fertile ground for Wagnerian mysticism. Belgian cities, with their Gothic and Baroque architecture mingling with Art Nouveau, created dreamlike settings reminiscent of Wagner's operatic worlds. Georges Rodenbach's novel Bruges la Morte captured this atmosphere, while Maurice Maeterlinck's plays echoed Wagnerian themes of forbidden love in decaying kingdoms. The notion that Wagner's music tapped into devilish forces gained wide currency among both detractors and disciples. Fin de Siècle culture attributed supernatural powers to artists, with Wagner supposedly capable of administering an oral potion of death. Superstitious observers noted a string of misfortunes befalling those close to Wagner. Tenor Ludwig Schnorr von Carolsfeld died shortly after creating the role of Tristan. Ludwig II drowned in 1886. Pianist Joseph Rubinstein committed suicide in 1884. Even Wagner himself worried his music might drive people insane, writing after Schnorr's death, "My Tristan, my beloved, I pushed you to the abyss." Anti-Jewish sentiment had deep historical roots in Germany long before Wagner's time, with influential figures like Martin Luther, Immanuel Kant, and Johann Wolfgang von Goethe expressing various forms of prejudice. However, Wagner played a pivotal role in transforming traditional religious anti-Judaism into a more insidious form of racial anti-Semitism. His personal hostility emerged in the 1830s during his early career struggles in Paris, where he began blaming Jewish financiers and composers for his commercial failures. This antipathy intensified dramatically after 1849, when both his musical aspirations and revolutionary political hopes collapsed following his exile from Dresden. Wagner's infamous essay, Jewishness in Music, appeared in September 1850 under the pseudonym Ka Freigedanke, Free Thought, in the Neue Zeitschrift für Musik. Written during his first sketches for the Ring Cycle, it articulated his belief that Jews were cultural parasites incapable of creating authentic art, being merely imitators of European culture. The essay contained particularly disturbing physiognomic descriptions of Jewish speech patterns, which he characterized as hissing, shrill, buzzing, grunting. Wagner claimed to hear these same qualities in the music of Felix Mendelssohn, whom he had once admired. He introduced the loaded concept of Verjudung, Jewification of modern art, suggesting Jewish influence was corrupting German culture. The essay concluded with the notorious suggestion that Jews needed redemption through Untergang, going under, a deliberately ambiguous term that has sparked intense scholarly debate over whether Wagner meant cultural assimilation or physical destruction. Though Wagner's operas contain no explicitly Jewish characters, musicologists and scholars have identified numerous anti-Semitic caricatures in figures like Alberich, the greedy dwarf, Mime, the scheming craftsman, and Sixtus Beckmesser from Die Meistersinger. Wagner's 1848 Ring sketch describes the Nibelung dwarfs burrowing with shifty, restless activity like worms in a dead body, language that directly parallels his pamphlet's description of Jews as a swarming colony of worms. While Wagner never explicitly identified these characters as Jewish in his writings, his contemporaries readily made the connection. Gustav Mahler, himself Jewish, poignantly remarked, "I know of only one mime, and that is me," acknowledging the painful recognition of anti-Semitic stereotypes in Wagner's work. The complex phenomenon of Jewish Wagnerites found its most prominent and paradoxical example in Hermann Levy, the Jewish conductor whom Wagner selected to premiere Parsifal at Bayreuth in 1882. Despite Wagner's initial discomfort with a Jew conducting his most Christian work, he recognized Levy's exceptional talent. Wagner had suggested Levy be baptized before the premiere, a deeply insulting proposition that Levy firmly rejected. Yet remarkably, Levy maintained an almost religious faith in Wagner's genius, writing to his father that the composer was the best and noblest person and that his anti-Jewish stance springs from the noblest motives. This cognitive dissonance exemplified the complicated relationship many Jewish musicians and intellectuals maintained with Wagner's art, separating the composer's repugnant personal views from his revolutionary musical achievements. Wagner's works center on the redeeming power of love, yet his personal attitudes toward women were complex and often contradictory. While idealizing feminine spirit, he imposed subservient roles on women in his life. He told Cosima that women have nothing to do with the outside world and should not try to turn into a man. Yet Wagner himself exhibited non-traditional masculine behaviors, fetishizing pink silk and satin fabrics, wearing feminine gowns and undergarments, and using rose perfumes in what some scholars call a form of cross-dressing. Women's relationship to Wagner's music created a fascinating cultural phenomenon. Female attendance at Bayreuth was remarkable. One observer noted, "One wealthy papa to six daughters and retinue of young ladies." American women, particularly Southern groups, traveled together to the festival, often focusing on the morally improving Parsifal. Wagner's music offered women self-expression otherwise discouraged by social norms. Soprano Lillian Nordica connected her operatic experience to suffragist activism, declaring the stage the only place where men and women stand on a perfect equality. She performed at suffragist pageants in 1913, accompanied by Wagner's music. By the end of the 19th century, campaigners for gay rights had incorporated Wagner into their cultural genealogy. This queering of the Meisker drew on the sexually transgressive elements in his works and his proximity to Ludwig II, who became a gay icon of the fin de siècle. Wagner himself showed an open, if sometimes confused, understanding of same-sex love. In The Artwork of the Future, he praised Greek monerliebe, love between men, as the noblest and most selfless expression of the human sense of beauty. Parsifal has long invited queer interpretations with its imagery of spears, wounds, and fluids. When Kundry kisses Parsifal, he recoils, clutches his heart, and cries, "Amphortas, the wound, the wound," gaining instant compassionate wisdom. When Ludwig II questioned this transformation, Wagner mysteriously replied, "That is a terrible secret, my beloved." Willa Cather's Wagnerism stands apart from other literary engagements with the composer, rivaled only by Thomas Mann in depth of understanding, though she possessed unique insight into singers and their artistic journeys. Born in Virginia in 1873, Cather moved to Nebraska at age 10, experiencing a cultural displacement that profoundly shaped her artistic vision and allowed for radical self-reinvention. Despite her outwardly conservative politics, Cather's work contains deeply subversive elements, rejecting American triumphalism and finding in Western landscapes, particularly the towering rock formations reminiscent of Brunhilde's fire-ringed mountain, a spiritual and artistic refuge from modern materialism and industrialization. Wagner's influence permeates Cather's early fiction with remarkable sophistication. Her 1905 collection, The Troll Garden, features multiple Wagner references that demonstrate her deep understanding of the composer's themes and symbolism. The Garden Lodge masterfully depicts a woman reliving the passionate Siegmund Sieglinde duet from Walkure in sensual reverie, capturing both the music's erotic power and its ability to transcend ordinary existence. Paul's Case presents a nuanced critique through its young aesthete's superficial attachment to Wagner's glamour, revealing the dangers of misunderstanding art's deeper meanings. Most significant is A Wagner Matinee, where Georgiana, a former Boston music teacher now worn down by 30 years of harsh Nebraska homesteading, attends a Wagner concert with her nephew Clark. As the Tannhauser Overture breaks the inconceivable silence of the plains, Georgiana undergoes a profound transformation that symbolizes both cultural awakening and personal redemption. Cather's pivotal 1913 meeting with soprano Olive Fremstad catalyzed her next artistic phase, deepening her engagement with Wagnerian themes. Born in Stockholm but raised in rural Minnesota, Fremstad's life story resonated deeply with Cather's own experiences of cultural displacement. Fremstad conquered adversity through sheer will, studying with the legendary Lilly Lehmann before making her triumphant Bayreuth debut in 1896. At the Metropolitan Opera, she became the reigning Brunhilde and Isolde, bringing unprecedented intellectual depth and psychological complexity to these iconic roles. In The Song of the Lark, Cather masterfully blends Fremstad's biography with her own experiences to create Thea Kronborg, a preacher's daughter from fictional Moonstone, Nebraska. Through her transformative Wagnerian experience in Panther Canyon, Thea emerges as a true Valkyrie figure, embodying both artistic awakening and feminist empowerment. The canyon scenes deliberately echo Walkure in their imagery and symbolism. The rim lit with coppery fire recalls Wotan placing Brunhilde beneath protective flames, while Fred becomes an urban Siegfried breaking her solitude. This parallel between landscape and operatic mythology creates a uniquely American interpretation of Wagner's mythic themes, connecting old-world artistry with new-world spaces and possibilities. Wagner proved crucial to modernism's development. As Nietzsche predicted, Wagner sums up modernity. It can't be helped. One must first become a Wagnerian. Indeed, many leading modernists began as Wagner devotees, absorbing his determination to enact a future that would annul the present. Three Wagnerian legacies stand out in modernism: the Gesamtkunstwerk, total artwork, the stream of consciousness technique, and the juxtaposition of myth and modernity. Though modernists often defined themselves against Wagner's romantic aesthetics, preferring hard lines over opulent textures, raw desire over epic passion, they nevertheless adopted his techniques while transforming them. Joseph Conrad's novels pulse with Wagnerian rhythms despite his claims of abysmal ignorance of the music beyond a single Brussels performance of Tristan. His prose style features incantatory repetitions and wave-like sentences that evolve in motivic fashion. In Heart of Darkness, the word darkness recurs like a leitmotif, building toward the inevitable final line about the heart of an immense darkness. Conrad's masterpiece Nostromo functions as a modern dress ring cycle, with the Sontome silver mine wreaking havoc like Wagner's cursed gold. Charles Gold, the mine's master, combines aspects of both Wotan and Alberic, wielding immense occult influence while becoming enslaved by his wealth. The novel's title character becomes master and slave of the Sontome treasure, echoing Alberic's curse. Virginia Woolf's relationship with Wagner was complex and evolving. Initially entranced, she visited Bayreuth in 1909, where Parsifal stunned her, writing that Wagner slides from music to words almost imperceptibly. Yet by 1913, she found Wagner intolerable, complaining of bawling sentimentality. Still, she continued returning to Wagner throughout her life, sometimes conducting along to recordings. The Waves, 1931, represents Wolff's most thoroughly Wagnerian work, described by William Blissett as the most despotically organized, the most composite, and the most pervasively leitmotivistic of her novels. Its opening evokes the prelude to Rheingold, with the sun rising over the sea until all round it the sea blazed gold. Through Bernard's final 60-page monologue, Wolff articulates her ideal of self-transcendence and mystical communion. I do not believe in separation. We are not single. On February 13, 1933, 50 years after Wagner's death, Thomas Mann delivered his lecture Sorrows and Grandeur of Richard Wagner at Amsterdam's Concertgebouw. The event, part of a brief European speaking tour, became Mann's permanent farewell to Germany, where Hitler had been appointed Reichschancellor 2 weeks earlier. Mann's lecture challenged the Nazi appropriation of Wagner, arguing that the composer ultimately belonged to the party of reform, change, liberation, the left. He boldly described Wagner as a figure who would most certainly be called a Kulturbolshevist today, using the Nazi buzzword for cultural Bolshevism. Hitler's Wagner obsession began early. In 1919-1920, he associated with Dietrich Eckart, a devoted Wagnerite who introduced him to Bayreuth's wonderful atmosphere. By 1922, Wagner excerpts were introducing Hitler's speeches, with Meistersinger's Wach auf chorus blending with Nazi slogans of Deutschland erwache. His Munich apartment contained Wagner recordings, writings, and biographies. From Hitler's first days in office, Wagner became ceremonially central to the regime. Hitler attended Wagner commemorations on February 12, 1933, and Meistersinger capped the day of Potsdam in March. At Bayreuth that summer, swastikas replaced Wagner's autobiography with Mein Kampf in bookstores, prompting Walter Legg to call it a Hitler festival. Despite Wagner's official veneration, his works caused ideological trouble for Nazi leadership. Parsifal particularly troubled Goebbels, Rosenberg, and Himmler, who thought its compassionate message incompatible with Nazi ideology and wanted it removed from the repertory. Hitler disagreed, telling Wieland Wagner he wanted Parsifal performed against his own party. The opera's central message of knowing through compassion directly contradicted Nazi directives to suppress Mitleid, compassion, which Hitler explicitly denounced regarding Jews in December 1941. After the war, Wagner's music found a powerful new medium in cinema, where it became shorthand for epic grandeur, aggression, and conquest. The iconic helicopter assault scored to the Ride of the Valkyries in Coppola's Apocalypse Now originated with screenwriter John Milius in 1969. Despite Coppola's intended critique of American imperialism, the scene ironically transformed the ride into an anthem of American military might. Black Hawk helicopters blared it during the 1983 Grenada invasion. PSYOPs units played it in Iraq during both Gulf Wars. Today, Wagner remains both celebrated and condemned, a testament to art's power to inspire both humanity's highest aspirations and its darkest impulses. As Ross concludes, when we look at Wagner, we are gazing into a magnifying mirror of the soul of the human species. What we hate in it, we hate in ourselves. What we love in it, we hate in ourselves also.